You're listening to Radio Aryan at RadioAryan.com.
Welcome to Truth Will Out Radio. Today's date is Friday the 19th of April, 2019. You're listening to me, Sven Longshanks, and we are broadcasting live today at RadioAryan.com because it's Friday night over here in Britain, and as it's Friday night, that means we must have with us the producer of Adolf Hitler, The Greatest Story Never Told, Communism by the Back Door, and the Freemasonic Victors of World War II, Mr. Dennis Wise. Dennis, how are you doing tonight?
Yes, indeed, I'm fine on this very special day. I'm sure everybody can remember 3 o'clock this afternoon was the reckoning of the time when Jesus died for our sins. So a very special day.
It is. We've got the Easter weekend. We've got the resurrection and the Easter Sunday and the Easter Sunday. And we've got the Easter Monday as well. We haven't actually got anything religiously planned for this evening, but it is good to remember the reasons for these holidays, and that it's all about Christ conquering death. It's Christ's victory over death. Because a lot of people will just concentrate on, they'll just concentrate on the crucifixes, and they'll say, "Oh, it's terrible. It's somebody died. They lost." Well, no, he didn't die. He was victorious. That's the whole point of it. He was victorious over death.
And indeed,
no pagan gods that have ever succeeded in doing that. So put your faith in Christ and you'll be all right. Well, Dennis, your latest video, it's finally been produced, hasn't it? It's finally been published.
Yeah, well, I mean, somebody published it last week. They were quick enough to get it before YouTube clamped down on it. But I wanted to make one or two little, different arrangements to it. And so, consequently, it's back up again. It got clamped down again on YouTube. But I managed to get the whole thing up on my backup channel, which has been in subs every day this week, quite rapidly. So you can find the full version on Wiser Than The Wise channel and the clamped down version on the Dennis Wise channel.
You can probably find it on BitChute. Whoever it was that managed to get the unfinished version up, hopefully they will have managed to get the finished version up now and publish it.
It's still available.
Do you know what I mean? They must have been super quick to just snatch it up and put it on BitChute.
I mean, I didn't
even get a chance to see it. It was that quick that they actually banned it from your channel. And it surprises me.
Well, they didn't even actually put a title on it. You know, it was still under the, you know, trial video.
Trial
still
version.
Banned.
I think he had on it the new episode. It's the new episode. It's out. Well, no, it wasn't.
Yeah,
it does seem a lot better now. It's got the music going right the way through it, and you know there was a couple of typos that have been fixed. You always want the finished version to be seen by the public, really, not the the unfinished one.
But it's not easy because even though it's only 15 minutes long, the intensity of it all, and you know it's unbelievably easy to make a mistake for those people who don't ever dwell on videos. I can assure you,
Well, it's a great episode. I think it's a very good episode. I'm certainly looking forward to number 20. And we went through some of it last week. We got up about two-thirds of the way through it, just discussing it. Obviously, people can watch the video for themselves, but what we can do here is we hope we can expand on the subject matter because, as you say, you've only got 15 minutes to cram all these ideas in there. So we've got a little bit more time here. And we got up to...
Can I just say... A lot of people have been stunned, literally stunned, by Himmler's remarks. They were so shocked they could not believe it, some people.
Well, that's good to hear. But they shouldn't be shocked. They shouldn't be shocked and stunned by it because, I mean, we've been saying it for years, haven't we?
Correct.
The evidence is there. The evidence is there. It wasn't pagan. They weren't pagans. Very few of them were interested in that sort of thing, but only a tiny, tiny minority of them. And it wasn't policy to be involved in all of that. And as we've shown, Hitler mocked it. Himmler wasn't interested in changing Christianity, getting rid of Christianity, any of that. What they were interested in doing is cleansing Christianity from the Jewish influence, which was the first heresy, was Judaizing. So they were doing nothing different to what the original, the problems that the original Christians had was with Jews trying to Judaize Christianity. And it's the same today. We still suffer with the same problem today. And we'll get into that a little bit later on. But one of the things you point out, Dennis, was about these corruptions. Some of the corruptions that the Jews have made with the Bible, and one of them itself is just with the word Jew and the amount of times that it's actually changed the spellings of it, and the first time that we actually heard the word Jew. I mean, do you want to go into that a little bit?
Yeah, well, I thought this was important because it tied up with the previous clip of how they used the word Jew to fool people who were part of Judah. And the other one, I can't quite remember the other one now, but it's all been like a bit of a scam, if you like. But when they first started printing the Bible, this is back now in 1300s, I think, something like that. The Wycliffe Bible, which was the first English Bible to be printed, the first spelling of that word, Jew, J-E-W, was actually G-Y-U. Jew. And that then went on to G-I-U and then I-U. Because the problem were, there's no J in Latin. Obviously, the Bible's written in Latin. And this causes confusion. But even so, after that, I-U-W, Jew, if that pronounces, then I-E-U-U, I-E-U-I, I-double-E, I-W-E. This is all over a period of centuries, I-O-W, I-E-W-E, I-U, I-E-U-E, I-U-E, I-E-E, and then I-E-W, until in the 18th century, finally, we get to J-E-W, which everybody knows today is Jew. But, you know, like I said, this is, I mean, the Jews claim to be part of Judah, by using that word Jew, and that only happened in the 18th century.
I think up until that point, the people that we refer to as Jews, they were referred to as Talmudists. Talmudists.
Well, I would have done, yeah. That's how I would have, because that's what they preached.
And because that was their religion. That was their religion, don't forget. Yeah. Because people thought that the religion of the Old Testament, it was the Judean religion, and these people, they're following the Talmud. They're not following the Old Testament. So they're Talmudists. And I think when they came up with this new word Jew, I think that helped them to disguise the fact that they were these Talmudists. They were the Pharisees more than anything else. That was the origin of their religion.
That eliminates Jesus from being a Jew by religion. Because you can either be Jew by religion or by race, so to speak. So, but obviously Jesus is not going to follow the Talmud because he obviously criticizes him, puts him in hell, burning in excrement.
Well, at the time, I mean, Jesus was criticizing the Pharisees, and he was saying, "You are following the teachings of men," or "You are following the commandments of men," as it is in some translations. And that was the Babylonian Talmud, and that was this oral teaching that the Judeans just made it up, really. They claimed that it was given to them at the same time as the written teachings by Moses. But there's no mention of any oral teachings in the Old Testament. There's no tradition of oral teachings from Moses until you get these, basically, some of the tribe of Judah that came back from Babylon. And then they started interbreeding with these Edomites, Edomians, as we'll get into later. And they followed this religion, which was basically proto-Talmudism. And they had their false temple, which Herod built. He totally rebuilt the temple. And Jesus was criticizing this stuff, and he was saying it's the commandments of men. It doesn't come from God. It just comes from men. And then in the 6th century AD, so 6 centuries after Christ, what the people who have become known as, are known as Jews now, these Talmudists, they wrote that down. They wrote down the Talmud, and that's when you got rabbinic Judaism. So that's when the religion formed, was the 6th century AD. 6 centuries after Christ, the religion of Judaism came into being. And people today think that the religion of the Old Testament is Judaism, and they think that what the Jews today are following goes all the way back to the Old Testament, and it doesn't. It came after Christianity.
Yeah, slice the band.
Yeah, so Jesus could never have been a Jew, because this rabbinic Judaism didn't come about till then. What you had in the Old Testament, you had the Hebrew religion, which was followed by the tribe of Judah and by the 10 tribed house of Israel. And then after the dispersion, when a tiny remnant of Judah, 10% of the tribe of Judah, which is 1% of all the tribes of Israel, that 1% went back to what was originally the land of Judah, and it became the land of Judea. And then they amalgamated with these Edomites, and the religion that they had amalgamated with what these Edomites had as well, and also what they'd picked up in Babylon, and that became the teachings of men, and the teachings of men then became the Talmud in the 6th century, and that was like the history of it. And all the way along, Jesus is distancing himself from it and calling these people that are following it, he's calling them devils. So he couldn't have been, religiously, he couldn't have been a Jew. And he couldn't ethnically have been one either, because he said that these people came from the devil. Their father was a murderer from the beginning. That meant that they came from Cain. And he wasn't calling himself a devil. He can't have been a Jew, basically. But you also...
Well, there's another aspect to it, because they're not, the Jews in Judea weren't racially Judeans. They were actually invited in. And so they were, you know, part of Judea, but not racially part. They were just, you know, welcomed in, because, and they were probably happy about it, because they'd always been on the outside as Edomites. So, but still, they're not racially Judeans.
No, we'll get into that in a bit, because this is the bit that that people, again, this is where they became mixed race. This is where they got their hooked nose from. This is why you can say Jesus didn't look anything like them. And we'll get into that a little bit. In the next bit. But I wanted to ask you about the inscription on the cross, because that fits in with this as well.
Of course it does, yeah. I mean, it's a perfect example of the corruption of that word Jew, because above the cross, and now since I've researched this, I found out that they're actually saying there was three inscriptions, which I found out to believe. One was in Latin, one was in Greek, and one was in Aramaic. But you're either likely to put three inscriptions up on a cross, I would have thought. But the one which everybody goes by is what Pontius Pilate himself wrote in his native tongue, and like Benjamin Friedman says, he's hardly not going to understand his native language. And he actually wrote, and again, there's no J in Latin, so Jesus is like spelled with an I-E-S-U-S. So it's Iesus Nazarenus Rex Iuda Forum. That sounds near enough. And that was always translated as Jesus of Nazareth, King of the Jews, which it does not translate. It actually, the correct translation is Jesus the Nazarene, leader of the Judeans. And the reason people thought he was from Judea was because he was born in Bethlehem because of the census. But actually went back to Galilee and lived most of his life there and was preaching there, which is why Hitler and others always used to refer him as the Galilean.
Yeah, Flavius Josephus, he calls them the Galileans, the Galilean sect, and Julian the Apostate, later on, he refers to the Christians as the Galileans, because that was where Jesus came from. He was a native of Galilee, not of Judea. But just one point there that you're pointing out, that the inscription in the cross was written in three different languages, and that's because Judea was a multicultural place. It was like London today. London is full of different races, different nations, different tongues, and you know, you end up with road signs written in English, written in Hindi, written in Punjabi, written in Arabic, and it was the same thing then. I mean, that just shows it, doesn't it? If they had to have it in three different languages, that shows you that Judea was multicultural, doesn't it?
Well, I've never seen that in any form. I mean, you know, maybe they did, but to me it seemed quite strange, because, you know, I thought Pontius Pilate would have just wrote that, and you know, anybody translating it, it would have just been a delay in the crucifixion, if you like.
Well, it's logical, really. I mean, there's also the Behistun rock, and that was put up by one of the Persian kings, and that's written in four different languages. And it's because he carved that rock in four different languages that we were able to understand these other languages. Because one of the languages was Akkadian, and we had already worked out how to understand Akkadian, so we were then able to understand these other languages from comparing the translations. Right. So whenever you got these...
Well, my problem then is, why is it translated Jesus of Nazareth, King of the Jews, in the other two languages?
Well, because they're trying to pull one over on us, aren't they? Because the translators are trying to pull one over on us. But what I'm saying is this idea of multiculturalism that is being forced on us now, that was going on thousands of years ago.
Yeah.
It's nothing new. And there have always been people that fought against it. And the people that were fighting against it then, they ended up in Europe. And all the rest of the ancient world, that ended up being Arabized. That's what the end result is. Everybody becomes an Arab through race mixing, and the civilization falls apart. And next we'll get into who these Jews actually are. And this is really important, I think, because people just ignore this. And it is so important to show that the Jews are not the people of the Old Testament. If you think, you know, 60% of people in Britain and America identify as Christian. And if you identify as Christian, then you think that the Israelites of the Old Testament are very important people. And there's a verse in there that says, if you bless Israel, you will be blessed. If you curse Israel, you will be cursed. And if Christians think that today's Jews are those Israelites, there is no way that they are going to criticize them. There's no way they're going to go against anything that they say. And they're going to treat them as if they are very special people. So it's very important to show that in actual fact, they are not the Israelites. And it gets worse than that. Because not only are they not the Israelites, they are the people against whom God has indignation forever. I mean, they are accursed people.
Yeah.
And this is something that really sort of picked up traction after the war. And I've got a book which traces this, the realization of this. And the author says, what is Hitler going to do now that this information is out there? And Hitler didn't do anything because there was only about a year left of the war. And they had basically said that today's Jews were the people of the Old Testament. And this contradicts that. And still people today think that it's going to be more practical to ignore this. And I just don't understand it, because it's very, very easy to prove. It's so easy to prove. You don't have to look at ancient texts, ancient books. There's no stretching of the imagination. You can prove it just from looking at Wikipedia, because this is a fact of history, basically. So we'll go over to Wikipedia and we'll look at these Edomites, Esau, which is basically who these Jews are. And if you look up Esau on Wikipedia, it says Genesis 26 to 34 describes Esau's marriage at the age of 40 to two Canaanite women, Judith, the daughter of Beeri the Hittite, and Bashemath, the daughter of Elon the Hittite. And this arrangement grieved his parents. And it actually tells us in the Bible that Sarah, the mother of Jacob Israel and Esau Edom, she said her life would not be worth living if Jacob Israel did the same, and that these wives were a grief of mind to her. So they were really upset that one of their twins, Esau, had race mixed, basically. So upon seeing that his brother, and then Sarah basically said, look, but you're going to have to take the blessing, Jacob. And Jacob dresses up as Esau to get the blessing from his father, because she knew that this blessing could not possibly go to Esau because he had race mixed. It meant that all his mixed race offspring would get the blessing. So upon seeing that Jacob Israel had got the blessing rather than Jacob Esau, and that their father had rejected Esau's union to the Canaanites, this is what Wikipedia says, upon seeing that his brother was blessed and that their father rejected Esau's union to the Canaanites, Esau went to the house of his uncle Ishmael and married his cousin Mahalath, the daughter of Ishmael and the sister of Nebajoth. And what that shows us is that this was the reason why why that blessing went to Jacob Israel. Because a lot of people say, well, that was really, really naughty of him. He stole his brother's blessing. But it was because he had race mixed. And the Bible tells us this because Esau realized what the reason for it was. And he thought, well, I'll go and marry my uncle Ishmael's daughter then. And then maybe they won't think so badly of me. But these Ishmaelites, they had lots of black and brown slaves and they interbred with them as well. They were just as bad as these Canaanites were within years of this actually mm-hmm. happening. And then you can look at Hebrews, and this is from the New Testament, and there's a verse there, again, which confirms this. And it says, lest there be any fornicator or profane person as Esau, who for one morsel of meat sold his birthright. And what that is saying, a fornicator means unlawful sex, which is sex with another race. And it's saying that he sold his birthright for one morsel of meat. And I think that's talking about the woman. I mean, it's like a double thing there because he also mm-hmm. sold his potage and what have you. But it's a play on words. It's saying that because he race mixed, he lost his birthright. And we go back to Wikipedia, it says Esau's family is again revisited in Genesis 36. This passage names two more Canaanite wives, Adar, the daughter of Elon the Hittite, and Aholibamah, the daughter of Anar, daughter of Zibeon the Hivite, and a third one, Bashemath, Ishmael's daughter, sister of Nebajoth. Casting his lot in with the Ishmaelites, he was able to drive the Horites out of Mount Seir to settle in that region. According to some views, Esau is considered to be the progenitor not only of the Edomites, but also of the Kenizzites and the Amalekites as well. And some of the listeners might be aware of the Amalekites, and they were a people that Israel were told to just wipe out entirely. And the Canaanites, these Canaanite women that he married, they were a totally cursed people. The Israelites had been told to exterminate them entirely. And not only had they been race mixing with these other races, they'd also been interbreeding the cattle, interbreeding the sheep. They were told to kill all the livestock as well because it was all polluted. Everything to do with this race was polluted. And then you've got Esau, the brother of Jacob Israel, marrying into this lot. And basically all of his descendants were Canaanites. This is why it was so wrong when Judah interbred with them. And after that, you get the Edomites first established a kingdom in the southern area of modern Jordan about 1400 BC, and later they migrated into southern parts of the kingdom of Judah, which is then called Edomia, or modern southern Israel, the Negev Desert, when Judah was first weakened and then destroyed by the Babylonians in the 6th century BCE. So when the tribe of Judah was taken to Babylon, these Edomites moved into that area. And then when the remnant of Judah came back there, first off, they kicked out all these peoples. And then eventually they started letting them back in again. And by the time we get to the 2nd century BC, so only 400 years later, when the remnant of Judah first came back, they were really good. They kicked out all the strange wives. They kicked out all the bastard children. Mm-hmm. It tells you about it in the book of Ezra and Nehemiah. You know, the high priest goes wild. He tears all his hair out, says, this is absolutely terrible. This is why we got kicked out of the land in the first place. You cannot have these strange wives. You cannot have these strange bastard children. We've got to get rid of them all. So they were really good at first, and they rebuilt the temple. But then 400 years later, they're up to their old tricks again. And this is Wikipedia again. Judas Maccabeus, the Judahite, conquered their territory for a time around 163 BC. They were again subdued by John Hyrcanus in 125 BC, who forcibly converted them, among others, because they also forcibly converted other tribes, to Judaism and incorporated them into the Judean nation. Herod Antipater... Yeah, Herod Antipater, the Edomian, the progenitor of the Herodian dynasty, along with Judean progenitors that ruled Judea after the Roman conquest, was of mixed Edomite Judean origin. So it's telling us that the monarchy then got taken over by these mixed race Edomites. And under Herod the Great, that's what the Jews call him today because he's their ancestor. He's really Herod the baby killer. The Edomia province was ruled for him by a series of governors, among whom were his brother Joseph ben Antipater and his brother-in-law Costobarus. So basically all the governors that he had under him were also Edomites. So they took over the government and the politics of the whole area.
As they do.
Yeah, this is the point. It's just as they do today. And he also had the high priest killed, and then he put an Edomite in his place. So they took over the religion, they took over the politics, they basically took over everything. And then you get to the time of Christ, and that's why he's calling these Pharisees devils, and that's why he doesn't want anything to do with them. And he says he came just for the lost sheep of the house of Israel. He's not interested in converting the Jews. All he's interested in speaking to is the lost sheep of the house of Israel. And it's because people don't realize this history that they think that it's confusing. And he's actually talking about the Jews when he's talking about the house of Israel, when he isn't. And then we can continue here from Wikipedia. It is presumed that the Edomian nation by the first century CE or AD had migrated northwards into Judea from places formerly held by them in the south during the time of Joshua. By 66 CE, a civil war in Judea during the First Judean-Roman War, when Simon Bar Giora attacked the Jewish converts of Upper Edomia. See, they're attacking the Jewish converts, the Israelites mm-hmm. are. They were brought near complete destruction to the surrounding villages and countryside in that region. According to Josephus, during the siege of Jerusalem in 70 CE by Titus, 20,000 of these Edomians, under the leadership of John, Simeon, Phinehas, and Jacob, helped the Zealots fight for independence from Rome, who were besieged in the temple. So it was all Edomians in the temple that got destroyed by the Romans. After the Jewish wars, the Edomian people are no longer mentioned in history, though the geographical region of Edomia is still referred to at the time of Jerome. And they are mentioned in the Jewish encyclopedias, where it says that Edom became the Jewish people, basically. So you got the Canaanite people that then took on the identity of the tribe of Judah, calling themselves Jews, and that have hijacked the history of the Old Testament. Now, I've got some Bible verses on it as well, but do you want to make a comment on that at all, Dennis, before I get into them?
Yeah, well, I mean, the shock on people's faces when you actually say, well, Jesus wasn't actually a Jew is unreal, because it really has been, stamped on people's brains that he was a Jew. And like you said, it's all this history which has been ignored. I mean, E. Michael Jones mentioned, I think he said the Jews are the chosen people because I think he said John said it, the apostle. But like you said, you know, they're getting them mixed up with the house of Israel. So E. Michael Jones goes off on the Jews are the chosen people.
Yeah, he gets it confused because he hasn't looked into this. He's just taken what the church tells him and what the Jews tell him as being gospel, basically.
But, yeah, I believe that. Yeah.
But people don't realize the ramifications of this. They think, well, what does it matter that the tribe of Judah interbred with Esau, Edom? They think, well, Esau, Edom was Jacob, Israel's brother. It was his twin. So it's not going to make any difference, is it? They don't think, well, hang on a minute. Even though he was Jacob, Israel's twin, he married all these Canaanite women. So all his offspring were Canaanites. Yeah. This is why the Jews say you're only a Jew if you're born of a Jewish woman, because they were the people that they were because they were born of these Canaanite women. They don't claim a patrilineal line. It's matrilineal, and the matrilineal line goes back to these Canaanites. That's their heritage. And then you can see what the Bible actually has to say about it, because these bits that I've read here from Wikipedia, they mainly come from Strabo and Flavius Josephus writing at the time. And I've got two Bible verses here. And the first one is from Malachi chapter 1, and that's a prophet in the Old Testament. And it says, "The burden of the word of the Lord to Israel by Malachi. I have loved you, saith the Lord. Yet ye say, wherein hast thou loved us? Was not Esau Jacob's brother? Saith the Lord, yet I loved Jacob." So what the Israelites are saying there is, where have you loved us? I thought it was Esau that you loved. And he said, "Yet I loved Jacob, and I hated Esau, and I laid his mountains and his heritage waste for the dragons of the wilderness. Whereas Edom saith, we are impoverished, but we will return and build the desolate places. Thus saith the Lord of hosts, they shall build, but I will throw down, and they shall call them the border of wickedness, and the people against whom the Lord hath indignation forever. So what they're saying, what he's saying there is that these Edomites will go back to where they were before and they'll try and rebuild it and God will destroy it. And that's the Jews today going back to Israel. And I've got another verse here, another few verses from Genesis 27. And this prophesies this happening as well. And this takes place just after Jacob Israel has been given the blessing and Esau has found out that his brother got the blessing. And this is what he says. And Esau said unto his father, hast thou but one blessing, my father? Bless me, even me also, O my father. And Esau lifted up his voice and wept. And Isaac, his father, answered and said unto him, behold, thy dwelling shall be the fatness of the earth and of the dew of heaven from above. And by the sword shalt thou live and shalt serve thy brother. And it shall come to pass when thou shalt have the dominion that thou shalt break his yoke from off thy neck. So what he's saying there is that Esau won't actually have a land. His dwelling will be the fatness of the earth and the dew of the heaven. And by the sword he will live and he will serve his brother. He will serve Jacob Israel, which is what the Jews did. They served all the kings. But it shall come to pass when he will have the dominion, Esau will have the dominion, and that started when you had the emancipation of the Jews and the French Revolution, and he shall break the yoke from off his neck. And that's the time of Jacob's trouble. And then it finishes with, and Esau hated Jacob because of the blessing wherewith his father blessed him. And Esau said in his heart, the days of mourning for my father are at hand, then will I slay my brother Jacob. And that's continued ever since. That's where this hatred comes from. Of the Jews for Europeans, for Christians, it goes right back to there and these two brothers. And it all starts, Esau started it by race mixing. He threw his blessing away because he wanted to get together with Canaanite women. He couldn't wait to go with someone from his own race with an arranged
marriage. And the Paulists suffered as well, didn't he? After, you know, setting them free from the ghettos, later on, he ended up being stuck on an island by the same people.
So he freed them, and then they punished him for it.
Yeah.
Well, that's like in Russia as well. I mean, the Tsar was really good to the Jews.
Yes.
And he gave them so many freedoms that they were able to form the Bolsheviks and massacre him and his family, take the whole country over, and then destroy it. And that's where the origin of this animosity comes from. I mean, there's an earlier animosity right in the first couple of chapters of Genesis, but maybe that can be talked about at another day. But this is just to explain who the Jews are. And you can say to Christians, that's who they are. They're not the Israelites. They're the Edomites. They're the descendants of Esau and his Canaanite wives. And of course,
I
was just going to say, and then after they were kicked out of Judea, and remember it said there that all the ones in the middle of the temple that the Romans destroyed, they were all Edomians. They left the land of Judea and they made their way up to Khazaria and they converted the Khazar monarchs and the Khazar aristocracy to the Talmud and they interbred with them and absorbed all the Khazars. And when you, I mean, I'm not Russian, but all the Russian church texts talk about it and how these Khazars interbred with the Jews. They followed the Talmud and they would tax the Russians and enslave the Russians and they had lots of wars with them. And eventually these Khazars came into Russia and came into Poland. And then eventually from there, they made their way into Germany. And they were known as Khazars in Russia and Poland. And then when they came into Germany, they became known as Ashkenazi Jews because the Germans themselves, they called Ashkenazi or Ashkenaz because they had this idea that the Germans were descended from Ashkenaz in the Old Testament. So that's why the Jews call themselves Ashkenazi Jews. It's the equivalent of calling them German Jews because they were Jews that lived in Germany, basically.
Yeah, we spoke Yiddish as well, didn't we? Which is like...
Yeah.
German version, in it, but I can't understand that there's people today who rebuff that, and to me it's history. You know, the fact that the Khazars, I mean, even today, I think is it something like 90% of Jews and Khazars down in Israel.
Yeah,
90%. And yet people, you know, they don't go along with that story anymore.
I don't understand it, Dennis, because this Edomite thing as well, it's all there in Wikipedia. It's not an article of faith. It's not some weird Christian identity fantasy. It's facts of history. And nationalists, the majority of nationalists are unaware of it and they ignore it and they think, well, the best way to convert Christians is to tell them what bad people the Jews are. But Christians aren't going to listen because they believe in God and they believe the Bible and they think that, it doesn't matter what men tells them. But if you tell them what God says these people are bad, he says they're cursed forever and they're nothing to do with him. Then
they'll believe you.
Yeah, then they might believe you because it's not you telling them it; it's the Bible telling them it. That's the important thing. I don't get it why people choose to ignore it because it is so obvious. Well, yeah, you mentioned Napoleon there as well, Dennis, and you talk in the video about how Hitler achieved more than Caesar and Napoleon and all these amazing things that he actually did. Do you want to get into some of those? And
yeah, I've actually moved that into the next part, to be honest, because I wanted to put an overlay of the Germans in World War II as the guys talking, which I'm intending on doing. But for now, like I said, it was in this earlier edition of 19, and the guy talking, I don't release his name because I didn't want any copyright strikes. You know, it would mean that YouTube would have to go through every lecture on YouTube to find him. So what he actually said, I mean, he was no friend of the Germans, trust me, and he actually said that he achieved more than Caesar and Napoleon did. And simply by, when he invaded Poland, that took 28 days and it was over. The next spring, obviously with the threat of Britain and France declaring war on him and coming into Europe, troops coming in there, he had to move quickly. And so by next spring, he took Denmark in one day. Then Norway, he took Norway to stop Churchill from actually getting it. And that took about 6 weeks. By April, it was over. And then he invaded the Netherlands, Luxembourg, Belgium and France. And these are all Rothschild strongholds where the British would have been able to launch from. And he took them, which nobody actually thought could ever be possible because only, you know, a number of years before in World War One, the Germans only got 70 miles and they were stuck there for the rest of the war. But this time, Hitler took all that area and the democratic states in just 7 weeks. Then later in April 41, he took the Balkans and then Greece and then Crete. Now the rest of Europe, like Switzerland and Spain, Portugal, Sweden was falling out. So anyway, they were selling iron ore with free transport and credit to Hitler. So the rest were all pro-Nazi anyway. And so what he's done amazingly since war was declared in Poland, he's got all of Europe back again, mainland Europe, and he's changed all the Rothschild leaders for Christian leaders. So once again, in just an amazing short space of time where he only lost 100,000 men, Europe is now back pre-World War One. Amazing.
And that's really what sort of gave birth to this Third Reich idea, wasn't it? It was uniting these countries as Christian countries again. And this is what the Pope wanted.
That's right. Ignore the fact that he's put Christian leaders in. Some people can say all they want that he made these stories up, these speeches just to get votes. But I mean, you know, this is getting silly. I mean, he's trying to create the Holy Roman Empire and he's actually done what he's been asked to do. If it weren't for the outside forces, like, you know, the Bolsheviks, which the bankers ran from America and London, and obviously the Americans eventually coming into war, that just changed the status quo. At the end of the day, you know, he did what he had to do. But the size of Germany, what it was incredible.
That is amazing, taking all those countries and liberating them in such a short amount of time. And apparently they only lost 100,000 soldiers. Balkans, Greece, and Crete only lost 100,000 soldiers. Greece is complaining today and saying that they want compensation out of Germany.
Mm. Well, I think he's talking that. To Mariam of Finland. You can hear it on YouTube. He mentions the fact that it was Italy's weakness that he had to go and sort out. He had to split his forces, his tanks, and a couple of divisions had to go down into Greece. And they did lose a lot of men down there. Apparently, they were fanatical fighting down there. But they managed to take it in the end. But yeah, he wasn't too pleased with Italy.
I thought they had quite a bit of support in the Balkans down there.
Well, that's the Balkans, isn't it? But Greece, I think the British got into Greece and got them stirred up to fight the Germans. I know Churchill was instigating down there.
Quite an amazing feat, anyway. When you think they had the whole world lined up against him. A world war, all against Germany,
yeah.
And he manages to go into these countries. And I think if he'd ruled with an iron fist or tried to rule over them, you know, they would have fought back. They wouldn't have come to these peace agreements and said, okay. I mean, because basically it was just guaranteeing that Britain wouldn't use them to get into Germany. Britain wouldn't be able to get through these countries to blockade Germany and prevent supplies getting in. That was the point of going into France, going into Norway, all of these countries was to prevent what happened in the First War, where they were blockaded and no supplies could get through. So that was the point of it. It wasn't about let's invade these countries and take them over. Because they said National Socialism is not for export. This is a German idea. They weren't about invading other countries and forcing them to go along with their ideas. And they put their...
Well, France, he could well have took revenge on France, but he never did. I mean, as we learned earlier that France sent colonial soldiers down into the Rhine Valley to mix, you know, to rape the German women. But he never took any revenge on that. Once he signed this agreement, you know, that Germany would rule France from a distance, so to speak, things were fine. But when the Allies invaded and, in inverted commas, liberated France, there was a film out called Occult Forces. People will probably remember it. And it was about Freemasonry and the evil of it and you know, the Germans using French actors to show what Freemasonry was all about. Obviously, France fell under Freemasonry with the French Revolution, and the producer and one of the actors was put to death for making that film.
Yeah, the liberation was no liberation. I mean, it was the destruction of France and the rape of the French and the partisans, the French resistance. They were terrorists. France had come to an armistice. They'd come to a peace agreement. The exiled government were nothing to do with it anymore. Churchill had actually gone and bombed the naval fleet, as we talked about in an episode a while back. France was furious. The French people were furious at Britain for doing that. And it's all portrayed today as this glorious liberation of Europe, when it was Hitler that freed Europe from the bankers. And he obviously had God's blessing to do so. It's a shame he didn't fully succeed, but he did succeed in protecting Western Europe from Bolshevism.
Yeah, it is. Which is something, I suppose. Could have been a lot worse.
It could have been. Well, next up, you talk about what happened when they went into Austria with the crown jewels. And we've discussed this a bit before, but it's worth going into again, I think, because we'll concentrate on the guy that actually went and secured these crown jewels this time, Walter Buch. But do you want to just relay that story for the listeners again, what happened when they went into Austria?
I think you've got some extra information on it, which you've found last week, but it's a similar thing what happened in Poland. He uses the SS to go ahead of you know, the main army, and certainly 3 days before Germany moved into Austria, he'd sent Buch into Austria to secure the crown jewels. He didn't wear a uniform. He was told to stand guard, and if anybody attempted to take him, to kill him, shoot him. What he did to the letter. Come the day of the Germans joining up with Austria again, he changed into his SS uniform and then took the crown jewels and with a Roman salute, just handed them over to Hitler to be taken back to his rightful home in Nuremberg, which they did in an eight carriage train under heavy guard.
And he went on to amass a massive relic collection, which I think shows that Hitler had he had Catholic loyalties, but he wasn't against the Protestants. I think this is one of the amazing things about him. He wanted to unite both the Catholics and the Protestants. And you would think that who he would send to check on these jewels and make sure that these jewels were okay, you would think, well, it would be a Catholic, but it wasn't. It was actually a Protestant. I've got some information on this Walter Buch here, and this comes from the Holy Reich. Walter Buch also emphasized the inspiration of Jesus as a person. As chairman of the party's Investigation and Conciliation Committee and president of the party's Supreme Court, he had one of the most powerful positions in Nazism. He had the power to discipline, expel, and punish all party members, and none of his judgments could be overturned save for Hitler's direct intervention. Martin Bormann, who would achieve infamy near the end of the party's life, was Buch's son-in-law. According to his biographer, Bormann married Buch's daughter to gain entry to Hitler's inner circle. And remember, Bormann is the one that supposedly annotated Hitler's table talks. Otto Wagner, Hitler's confidant in the Kampfzeit, named Buch as one of only three men who were prepared and in a position to tell Hitler their own views when they contradicted his. So he was a close friend of Hitler's. Like the others surveyed so far, Buch related Nazism as a movement to Christ's own struggle, sounding a distinct note of triumphalism. Unlike Goebbels or Eckhart, Buch was not given to literary flourishes, choosing instead to speak in a more straightforward manner on the relevance of Christ and Christianity for National Socialism. To an assembly of the National Socialist Student League, or the NSDSTB, he declared, "When point 24 of our program says the party stands for a positive Christianity, here, above all, is the cornerstone of our thinking. Christ preached struggle as did no other. His life was struggle for his beliefs, for which he went to his death. From everyone, he demanded a decision between yes or no. That is the necessity, that man find the power to decide between yes and no. This stark black or white vision makes clear the dualism of the National Socialist worldview." In addition, Buch drew direct comparisons not only between Christ's struggle and the National Socialist one, but between Christ's followers and members of the NSDAP. Just as Christianity only prevailed through the fanatical belief of its followers, so too shall it be with the spiritual movement of National Socialism. I've just got one more bit here. Whereas Eckhart, Dinter and Goebbels were all brought up Catholics, Buch was a Lutheran. So he wasn't a Catholic, but the others were. But that shows you that Hitler wasn't, playing favoritism just with the Catholics. This was a close friend of his. And that was the guy that he sent to make sure that these crown jewels were okay and safe. Yeah. And I just thought that, it's interesting to show that.
Yeah, well, it is. I mean, the fact is, the SS were allied or showed their allegiance to God, whether Protestant or Catholic, and that overrides everything. I mean, you know, he went out there and he understood his orders and carried them out to the letter.
And Hitler did do quite a lot to try and unite the two churches, and we talked about that.
Yeah,
as well.
That's where I found the sculpture in the church. It's a Protestant church in Berlin. It's got the carvings of Jesus amongst some German soldiers, and it's got Hitler there with his head bowed as in prayer.
I don't think I've seen that one. I don't think
right, well, that one. The actual one of Hitler has darkened it out a touch in the video that described with William Fink and Pastor Eli James, you know, the reasons Jesus not being a Jew. But if you look closely enough, you'll see a sculpture of just darkened out a little bit because it was too off-putting when it was too bright. And that's the one that they found. And there's not many statues and sculptures of Hitler around the world today, but they found that in a German church in Berlin, along with, like I said, the sculptures of Christ with the German soldiers.
Well, they do all they can to destroy them, don't they? I mean, they've got church bells with swastikas on that Jews are demanding should be taken down and smelted back into scrap metal. I mean, these beautiful church bells that were struck in honour of National Socialism, in honour of the amazing things that the National Socialist administration actually achieved for the country. And that shows you that they built up the churches, they invested in the churches, and they were well loved by the churchmen. There were lots and lots of churchmen that were involved in the NSDAP. And it was
just
such
the liberals, really, which were the problem.
Well, yeah, and there was such a close relationship, such a close relationship between them that Hitler thought that he would be able to begin like we have over here in Britain. We have the Church of England. He essentially wanted the Church of Germany, and it would be called the Reich Church. And they spent a good few years working on this and trying to get all the different Protestant denominations to come together under one church, and then you would have had the Reich Church, and you would have had the Catholic Church, and he was trying to get them to see themselves as Christians and as Germans, not to see themselves as
separate. Unfortunately, we found at Vatican II that Protestants were involved in destroying the Catholic Church. So I'm presuming at that time when Hitler was trying to, sort it out, that there were Protestants against joining with the Catholic Church.
Well, there were progressive Protestants, the same as there were progressive Catholics that were trying to stop things happening. Yeah. But he wasn't able to. It was a failure, which he was really quite upset that he failed, because he worked really hard at trying to get these all the different Protestants together. Because they saw Martin Luther as a nationalist, as a German nationalist that exemplified German individualism, German willingness to question authority, and his bravery in questioning the Catholic Church, and also in realizing what the Jews had done to Christianity. I mean, right near the end of his life, he wrote On the Jews and Their Lies, which basically overturned everything that he had thought before, because he learned everything from these Jews. So they saw him as a hero. Right. And obviously, Hitler saw the Catholic Church itself as an amazing organization that managed to bring together the separate sovereign nations and prevent them from warring against one another, and that became the final arbitrator on issues that needed solving. So if you've got problems today, people go to the EU, they go to the Human Rights Court in the EU. Back then, you would take your issues to the church. And because the church was separate, or because the Catholic Church was separate, the Pope was separate, he was seen as an arbitrator of these disputes, it was based on biblical law, not based on man's law, like human rights crap. It was all based on biblical law. And these countries that you had, that's why it was Christendom, is because they all followed Christian law. They tried to follow Christian law. They tried to look after the poor in their nation. And it was expected that the rich would look after the poor, because that's why they had that money. That's why they were rich. And not look after the poor from any other nation, but just from within your own nation. And then you had this supernatural thing, the Catholic Church, that held it all together.
Yeah, the thing is, right, is what the point that people miss is pre-1945, in fact, I believe 1946, they were infiltrated. But pre-1945, it's a different Vatican to the post one, because obviously the infiltration of Freemasonry was found, after years and years of being condemned by the Catholic Church, suddenly Freemasonry was accepted now. That's because Freemasons ran the Catholic Church. And so it's a totally different, like, I mean, a Jesuit mainly before 1945 would have been a fascist. And as we see today, we've got a Jesuit Pope who's probably the most liberal ever. But there's two different Vaticans, which people have to remember.
I think they were the last organisations to fall, was the Catholic Church, to fall to Freemasonry.
Yeah, and probably the only one to challenge it, because I can't think of another one.
I'm struck to think of anything. I mean, I can think of people challenging the Jews, like Martin Luther did, and various others. But again, it's always been the Catholics that most stood against them. And going right back to the beginning, the Pope was producing these papal bulls, which was preventing them from intermarrying Christians, preventing them from having Christian slaves, making them wear separate clothing so that we could tell them apart. So we knew that this wasn't a member of our own nation, and he would not be looking out for our best interests. He would be looking out for his best interests. Because if you think you had homogenous nations up until that point, everybody would be expected to be looking out for somebody, looking out for their other people. Why would you rip somebody else off when they're part of your community? You're just taking from, you know, if you need something, you would be given it because you're a part of the community. So they were slightly naive, and the Jews could capitalize on that. They could take advantage of that. That's why the church made it so that they had to wear these special clothes. And it's the same thing Adolf Hitler did.
Yeah, to protect the Christians.
To wear the star. To protect the Christians. And this is that...
to protect us,
Sic et Judaeus non, that E. Michael Jones talks about, that you cannot harm the Jew, but at the same time, the Jew cannot subvert your nation. And the ways that you prevent the Jew from doing that is get them to wear clothes to identify him for a start, get him to live in a separate area, that's another start, prevent him from having slaves, prevent him from having civil offices. This is all the ways that you do that. And the Catholic Church worked out all these, you know, very, very well thought out ways that we could live alongside them, but separately. And Adolf Hitler just did the same thing.
Benjamin Freeman actually came out with statements and said he would like to see where in the Bible it actually says, do not harm the Jew, because he doesn't believe it says anywhere.
It doesn't say it anywhere. It doesn't say it anywhere. But, we should treat people how we would like to be. How we would like to be treated. And I guess you think, well, if I was to be treating people in a bad way like that, I would like it to be known to me. I would like to be punished, disciplined, so that I learn not to treat people in a bad way like that. So I guess that's the sort of way of thinking about it. But no, of course, it doesn't say that. I mean, what the Bible
when
says...
When we're a minority, we'll see.
What the Bible says is, don't seek their peace. The nations around you have nothing to do with them. Don't seek their peace. Don't have peace treaties with them. Don't have anything to do with them. Don't marry strange women. Don't have strangers in your country. Don't put strangers in positions of government, because they will rule over you. That's what the Bible says. It doesn't say, you know, invite foreigners in and then treat them nicely. It says don't have anything to do with them. Foreigners of your own race, foreigners of your own nation, then you're supposed to treat them well and treat them with the same laws. But people that are of different bones and different flesh to you, then they are supposed to be kept separate. It says that God created the separate nations with their separate boundaries and their separate times. And they're not to be all mixed together. They were all mixed together in Babylon. And that's when God confounded the language to stop them from all mixing together into one empire. And before that, again, you've got a huge, huge race mixing incident with the sons of the gods, or the angels, or the sons of God, seeing the daughters of men and interbreeding with them. And that was the cause of the flood. You know, God destroyed all of it because of the race mixing that went on. So the idea of allowing other races in and then mixing with them is not biblical. It's Babylonian. It goes right back to Babylon before the flood. Satanic. It is satanic in essence to destroy the creation that God has created. God created everything kind after kind, and it was supposed to be kept in its kind, not mixed together. If you think about it, that's the only way you could get evil into a world that was all good. It tells us that the world was perfect.
Yeah,
it's
yeah.
all good. And yet somehow we get evil in the world. And how could that be? It could only be if one kind mixed with another kind and created something that wasn't created by God, a new being that didn't come from God. That's the logic of it. That's the logic of it. All right, Dennis, thank you very much for coming on today.
Yeah.
I think that's been a great episode.
Interesting, yeah.
Thank you very much, listeners, for listening. We will be back next Friday with more Truth Without Radio for you. And, of course, we do hope you all have a great Easter weekend.